Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
So I did a bit of a writing on this... the sutra called Thundering Silence. It's a sutra on the better way of knowing how to catch a snake, which I thought was just a neat title for a sutra. Knowing the better way to catch a snake. And I guess for myself it has many connotations to it, but it's a very short sutra, and it seems simple, but as with all the Buddha Dharma, not so simple, very complex, and not exactly what you might think, even after reading the sutra. So I wrote a little poem, and then we'll dive into it a bit. It's not. This is because that is that, the riddle of all that arises and all that falls away. When the oar is pushed through the water, the boat is propelled. When the eye of desire falls on its target, is not fantasy and grasping born? How many targets does it take for the one desire to extinguish? No matter how broken the vessel may be, it cannot be thrown away or sold off for a new one. Broken and new are the hook of the fisherman. He dangles it in front of the jester of confusion. Desire remains the great destroyer of peace. But aren't these just more words to add to the arsenal? Like bullets striking dead center. Hypnotized by the intellect, the same potholes continue to break ankles. There must be another road to follow. The old ones must be abandoned if the snake is to loosen its grip. So this sutra tells the story of a monk at the time of the Buddha, Arita, something like this. I always try and pronounce it, but I'm not Indian, so. Arita was heard to say that, I'm not going to read the whole sutra, but was heard to say and to continue to tell everybody that Buddha said that pleasure or desires were not an obstacle to the practice or an obstacle to the Buddha Dharma. So Arita had just kept telling all his friends and telling all the monks and kind of getting in all these arguments about it. No, the Buddha said pleasure is not a problem to this, you know. Desire is not an obstacle to the path, you know. And so a bunch of the monks went back to the Buddha, told on Arita. I always love that. And so the Buddha had this discourse with Arita to ask him serious questions. Do you really believe that I have, this was a part of my teaching, that my teaching was that sense pleasures are not an obstacle on the path? And he's like, yes, of course, that's what I heard you say. And so as they go on and the Buddha kind of really goes into this deep aspect of the teachings, the whole point of it is showing how easily it is to misunderstand these teachings, you know, because of the depth of these teachings. And because of, well, as we get more into it, because of this logical mind, you know, and that's that little line that I wrote in my poem, hypnotized by the logical mind, hypnotized by logic, I will convince myself of anything, you know. So easily. But then as we And this to me is what the Buddha Dharma is so powerful at. You know, they call it the psychology. The Buddhism is this psychology of the mind. Psychology of the mind and of the heart. And the Buddhist psychology, if you will. And this is, I think, the thing that really caught me about Buddhism. Because for years and years of my life, I kept stepping in these same potholes, logically knowing they were going to do the same thing every time. And yet I found myself stepping back in them every single time. And I lived in this state of confusion all the time. And so when I was introduced to the Buddha Dharma, it started to show me the path that leads me back to the origin, you know? What is the cause of my problems, you know? I was always stuck in the effects. But I needed to find out what the cause of those were, you know? And like I said in the beginning, at first glance you think, oh, okay, desire is the root of it. But as the Buddha discourses this deeper and deeper, it basically comes down to this aspect of attachment. Whatever I am attached to, desire grows from that. So I love it because it's almost mathematical, you know, like even though you may see the origin or the beginning, there's so many stages that it takes to get to the effect. Does that make sense? So we might see the cause, but there's all this whole entire pathway into the effect. Or likewise, backwards, you know, the effect into the cause. And so this to me is what really drew me to the Buddha Dharma, is this, the real psychology of what's really happening within us, you know. And then even to see beyond that, that if there is no true self, then what is happening, you know? If there's not this thing called me, because of course I blame myself for all these things. If there is not this self, if there is not this inherent self, this lasting self, then what is this process? What is happening here? So Thich Nhat Hanh writes, in the Sutra on Knowing the Better Way to Catch a Snake, the Buddha reminds us to be skillful and careful in learning and practicing, and not to be caught by words or notions. The teachings of emptiness, non-self, nirvana, etc. are cited in the sutra as examples of misrepresentations. The sutra affords us another opportunity to receive the teaching. The Buddha said, during 45 years, I have not said anything. This statement warns us not to be caught by words or notions. It is truly the roar of a great lion. If we get caught by words or notions, we will not be able to receive the true teachings of the Buddha. For this reason, we have given this book the title Thundering Silence. May the Sutra on Knowing the Better Way to Catch a Snake sweep away the fog of words and notions in us, so that the sun of the true teaching can shine brightly on the field of our understanding mind. And I love that last sentence, the way Thich Nhat Hanh writes that. Can sweep away the fog of words and notions in us, so that the sun of the true teaching can shine brightly on the field of our understanding mind. So in a very subtle and poetic way, he says we carry both illusion and enlightenment. We have it already within us. And to really dig into these teachings, we begin to sweep away this fog, the words and the notions. That's why the Heart Sutra is the Mahayana prayer that Mahayana Buddhism was based off of. Because as paradoxical as that is, it's stating a very powerful truth, that we are both. We are both emptiness and we are both form. We are both temporary and we are both forever. You know, this constant recycling of life, this constant recycling even in the opening of our Dharma, you know. Yet rarely has this been experienced. And if I look at my own life, you know, if I've been here for 54 years or something, how many times have I experienced the present moment? Rarely. I'm constantly torn up in my head. Constantly. You know. Remember in high school they used to do that? They come up to you and they go like this. Oh, you're running down the hallway. And then smack you in the head. You never had that. And that's what my brain is like. It's just constantly running. Constantly chasing. As I stepped into this, of course, as my practice deepens and my discipline deepens, all that stuff, I get these little interludes. Thank God for the interludes. Because they show me that there is something to this, you know. That's it. If that's all I've gained, that's it. Is I've gained some insight that there is really something to the Buddha's teachings. But then he says it right there. In 45 years, I have not said a single word. What is that, you know? That points to me that the Buddha is not this living being. Although a living being experienced it, the Buddha is this essence of life, you know. This pure essence that needs no words, it needs no nothing else. But us humans, we need a pointer, or we need a keisaku stick, you know. That's my experience. I need a keisaku stick. I need somebody to beat me up a little bit. This is where the teachings of the Buddha and the awakened ones always go beyond the level of self-consciousness and temporal. They go beyond this me, physical body. Anytime I've ever talked to another, well, somebody who's maybe enlightened in my eyes or whatever, they always would talk in these riddles because they were trying to touch that thing that you can't put a word to it. I can't pick it up and show it to you like that, you know. So they go below the me and the I in hopes of dragging the illusion out into the light. If we're not able to use these teachings correctly, then the conditioned mind and not the understanding mind rules the roost. The conditioned mind and not the understanding mind rules the roost. And we see this in all faiths, in all religions, in all practices. I mean, just look at yoga in our country. Yoga went from this really profound spiritual practice to a sport in our country, you know. Now you just have to make sure you have Lululemons on and you're doing good yoga, you know. That kind of stuff. The conditioned mind steps in and goes, no, this is the way it goes. And that's all the conditioning, you know, the gaining mind. Here's where it gets sticky. Because for most of us, we've so rarely entered into real contemplation. And so we've unknowingly placed ourselves in this fixed world of physical forms. Which means we rely primarily on the six senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, and thoughts, and the five aggregates. The five aggregates are form, consciousness, perception, feeling, and volition, which the six senses play into, of course. But the art of meditation is that when we become still and quiet enough, we are enlightened to this reality that is obscured by these unseen obstacles. That reality exists below the level of consciousness. So, this is why Master Dogen said to drop away body and mind. I always remind people of this when we practice meditation. Give it up. When you want to move, who cares? Just sit. When you fall asleep, wake up quickly. You know? We're in this internal conflict with the body and the heart, the body and the mind, you know? And so when we take this cushion, the cushion is asking us to practice every moment. I had this little thought this morning that boredom is the great revelator. The minute you are okay with being bored, then you will be okay sitting zazen. Because you're literally sitting here in this state of, you're either waiting for something to be done or you're waiting to get to something. So we need to throw those away. They don't work here. So this enlightened quality or this enlightened state that we can tap into, it simply gets obscured by this, the aggregates and the senses. And that's why we have these minds that are doing this. Because we're always searching, always chasing. You know? I wanted to read this bit here. The Sutra on Knowing the Better Way to Catch a Snake does not aim at expounding the harm of sense pleasures or explaining concepts of no self, nirvana, or tathagata, although the sutra does mention these concepts. The main purpose of the sutra is to demonstrate the necessity of breaking the bonds of attachment. The Buddha shows us why it is a hindrance to be attached to anything, including his own teachings. That is why he says, let go of all the true teachings, not to mention teachings that are not true. This is the quintessence of this sutra and of all Buddhist teachings. The word translated as teachings in this sentence is Dharma. This spirit, this way of breaking through the bonds of attachment, is the foremost element of the Buddhist teachings. Breaking the bonds of attachment is the most skillful and intelligent way to practice. We study the Dharma to understand and practice it, not to accumulate knowledge. Knowledge not used skillfully is an obstacle to understanding. And I think that's that fine balance between it. I know for myself, if I would have never read any Buddhist teachings, I would have very little understanding of what they were pointing at. Just like if I never learned to sit zazen and really sit here, I would never have those moments, those experiences of no self, of true present moments, you know? I wouldn't have them. So I have to find this balance of not holding on and not throwing it all away, you know? It's really wild, wild practice, wild, wild balance. And the same thing in zazen. It's so easy to sit here and just be like, you know, the minute I start to get sore, the minute I start to get tired, I search to the mind for a nice story, you know? It's nice. I can just go right into that little room and disappear from right here. It's very nice. I've learned how to do it really well. And so all of that stuff that's happening when we're really present, when we're really living this thing called awareness, I notice it quickly. I notice when I'm nodding off. You know, at nighttime I nod off so quickly. This has been one of my biggest challenges. I hate meditating at night. I do. Roshi used to make us meditate at like 10 o'clock at night. Oh, I hated it. Because I would just literally fall asleep in my cushion, you know. But as those practices, as I dived into those practices, it would reveal to me something that I was not able to see if I never did it. Just like when I had a daughter, I would never know what having a child was like if I never had my daughter. I wouldn't know it. And I would never know not even just that, but I would never know the sacrifices that my parents gave when I was born, you know? I wouldn't know it. I was so selfish. Oh my God. I called my mom like a month after my daughter was born. I'm so sorry. So sorry, I was such a shit for so long. So as you really dive into these, and it's such a beautiful, this is written by Thich Nhat Hanh, and he gives all these different commentaries and a bunch of really great little stories. There's a neat little story that he recounts about a man that was really sick, and somebody told him that he needs to eat a pheasant, but because he didn't know what a pheasant was, the man wrote or drew a picture of a pheasant on a piece of paper, and he says, "You need to eat this." So he ate the piece of paper. And then when it didn't fix him, he had 1,000 people draw him pictures of pheasants on him, and he was eating all these people. And so he was just getting sicker. And then a doctor finally came over and was like, what are you doing? And he took him to the store and he said, "This is a pheasant. You need to eat this." And the man ate the pheasant and he was okay. I mean, I don't know what kind of doctor that is, but... But that's how like easily it is for us to mistake these teachings. They're very powerful, very, very deep. It is truly the roar of a great lion. And I just wanted to say one more quick thing, and then I want to open it up. But the other day I saw this amazing little video, and they were filming an embryo in utero. Is that how you say it? Yep. And the baby wasn't formed yet, but somehow or another they were doing this time lapse video, and what they were videotaping was the nervous system growing. There wasn't a form yet, there wasn't a child yet. The nervous system grew first, and the child grew around the nervous system. But it was like, here's this little egg, and there's like this little thing coming out of it, and all of a sudden it starts to fan out into all these nerves that took the shape of a baby, and then the baby grew. You know, like this idea that we know what is happening has to be thrown away. We don't know what is happening. Just like, and they've also been able to do this time-lapse video of the moment that the egg and the sperm come together, and about 1 minute or 90 seconds after that fully comes together, there's like this electric shock that happens. The whole thing illuminates, and they say that's the seed of God. Boom. Now there's life. So it was like the little plug. Beep. Okay, now you're on. So we don't really know what's happening. You know, science is amazing at showing us these things that, you know, even maybe 30 years ago we would have never known. And the thing that always, for me, that always strikes me, and I know it to be true, is that the Buddha and these other enlightened beings saw all of that stuff without the aid of a video camera or a microscope or a ruler, you know. They saw all of those things as they stepped into this samadhi meditation, this deep, deep meditation.